problems too, but only because
of Hebrews 7. We're made our way to verse 11, actually, at this point. So 7:11. And he actually now is going to transition away from the first 10 verses of Hebrews 7 have been really a logical presentation of the superiority of Melchizedek's priesthood to that of the Aaronic priesthood. And that's what he's done. And I think he's proven it very well. There's not really much you can argue with based on what he said. Remember, he showed five reasons that it was superior, and then he made three logical conclusions based on that. And so it seems obvious that to any reader reading this, that yes, Melchizedek's priesthood had to be greater than Aaron's priesthood. So now in verses 11 through the end of the chapter, he's going to go back to the end of chapter 6 and say, so Jesus then, his priesthood supersedes, is superior to the Aaronic priesthood because he's after the order of Melchizedek. He introduced that subject the last verse of chapter 6. And now he's getting back to that in chapter 7:11. He's going back to that theme. And now that he's proven that the Melchizedek priesthood is greater or superior to the Aaronic priesthood, now he's going to say, and so because of that, Jesus' priesthood is therefore superior to the Aaronic priesthood. And that's the subject. Theme of the rest of chapter 7 is now tying it back to Jesus and bringing the last verse of chapter 6 into play here. So I'm just going to read a few verses and then we'll talk about those. I'm going to read up through 15. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe, from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, and in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. So he now ties it back in and says, okay, so if... And this theme is carried on in Galatians, and it's carried on in other places. If perfection, if the ability to please God, that's what that perfection means. If you track perfection throughout Hebrews, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about perfection. He's not just talking about completeness. He's talking about the ability to stand before God perfect and complete. If that's possible through the Aaronic priesthood, then there's no need for another priest to arise. There's no need for that. But it's been well proven throughout the history of mankind and the history of the law that it's not possible at all. There's no way that can happen. He's already mentioned that a little bit back earlier when the high priest went in on the Day of Atonement. He didn't just offer atonement for the people. He first had to offer atonement for himself because he was imperfect at keeping the law. And if the high priest representing the law is imperfect, then all of those under that are more than likely imperfect. There's no way, it was never intended to be the way that man achieved perfection or achieved the ability to stand before God perfect and complete by keeping the law. It was never intended that way. Rather, we know through Galatians, the law was always intended to show us our need for something else, someone else to keep the law for us. And so He starts this conversation saying, if it's attainable, if you can do that, then there doesn't need to be another priest who arises because that law is good enough and that perfection, that keeping that law is good enough. And therefore that provides for the perfection of people through the Aaronic priesthood. But that can't happen. That can't happen. And so there is a need. So this... The first question is a hypothetical, with the answer being, well, it's not possible to keep the law, and so there is definitely a further need for a different priest, a different priesthood that came after the order of Melchizedek. So that's his conclusion. Then Melchizedek is greater than Aaron, but if perfection was possible under Aaron, then you don't need Melchizedek again. If perfection was possible under Aaron, then that achieved what needed to be achieved, and there was no need then for Melchizedek. But because perfection is not possible under Aaron, then there needs to be somebody else. There needs to be somebody else. There needs to be another priest.
Melchizedek came first.
Melchizedek did come first. That's why he didn't jump from. That's exactly why he didn't jump from the last verse of chapter 6 to verse 7:11. That's why he didn't do that. That's why he took the time to show the superiority of Melchizedek's priesthood. That's why he did that. Exactly why he did that. Because if you are any way observant as a Jew, and you've been reading Hebrews, there's at least two times when you've said, when a red flag is, whoa, in chapter 2 and in chapter 4, both those times, the author of Hebrews referred to Jesus as a high priest. And if you're a Jew at all, any kind of observant Jew, that caused red flags to go up in your head. Why? Well, because he's not a Levite. He's not a Levite. And there's no way that a non-Levite could be a high priest. It just can't happen. It can't happen. In fact, there are serious consequences for a non-Levite acting in a Levitical role. There are serious consequences. Ask Saul. Saul had the kingship removed from him because he acted in that position. He acted as a priest. If you recall that back in, the people are gathered and waiting for sacrifice, and Samuel says to Saul, wait for me, I'll be there. And we did the work a couple weeks ago. Samuel is a Levite, so he's okay to be a priest. So Samuel says, wait for me, I'll be there. As Saul is waiting, and Samuel's delaying, and Samuel's delaying, and Samuel's delaying, and finally the people get restless. And so Saul's okay, I'm just going to do it. And Saul steps in as priest and offers sacrifice. And that's one of the big checks against him as the spirit is taken away from him. And then another time when he incompletely obeys or really disobeys and saves some of the Amalekites, like Agag. That's another one. But it's a significant issue when a non-Levite acts in a Levitical role. And so if you're just an observant Jew and you're reading through this and you haven't completely gotten there yet, and you hear the author of Hebrews saying, well, Jesus is a high priest, not once but twice, you should be throwing up some red flags. You should say, no, wait a second, he can't be our high priest. He cannot be a high priest. It doesn't fit. He can be our king. He's from Judah. He can absolutely be our king, but he cannot be a priest. That's exactly why the author introduces him from the order of Melchizedek and proves that he follows that line, not the line of Aaron, not the Aaronic priesthood. So that's why you have 1 through 10 of chapter 7 is to lay the foundation for the superiority of Melchizedek's priesthood to that of Aaron, because if you don't do that, and he's from the order of Melchizedek, maybe Melchizedek is subservient to the Aaronic priesthood, then he's proven nothing. He's proven nothing. There's no proof there that Jesus then is better, or that Jesus mediating whatever covenant he's going to mediate, which is actually what chapter 8 is going to talk about, the covenant that Jesus mediates. It doesn't affect anything. It affects a smaller group of people, not a larger. So now we're to the point where if we recognize what Jesus is, who Jesus is after the order of Melchizedek, his priesthood then represents a larger group of people because it precedes even the Jews. His priesthood precedes even the Jews, and so he represents a larger priesthood. So that's why 1 through 10 are there. But it's not just enough to say Melchizedek is greater than Aaron. Okay. Melchizedek's greater than Aaron. What you've got to do then is show that Jesus is a priest from the order of Melchizedek. Then that you've got to tie it back in to Jesus being that. And so that's what he's going to do. That's what the rest of chapter 7 is. It's tying Jesus in and associating him with Melchizedek, not with Aaron. There's actually a disassociation. Is that a word? Dissociation? Disassociation. I'm going to use it. If it's not a real word, I'm using it anyway. There's a disassociation with Aaron on purpose. He disassociates him with Aaron, and that's what he's doing here in this group of verses. He says, if Aaron's priesthood is good enough, you don't need somebody else. But we all know, that's a hypothetical, because we all know that Aaron's priesthood isn't good enough. There's nowhere ever, and we talked about this before, there's nowhere ever where any sacrifice that the Aaronic priests did ever removed sin. Never happened. Never was there a sacrifice that was offered by Aaron that was considered the satisfying sacrifice. Never happened. How do you know it never happened? Because they had to keep on doing it. They had to keep on doing it every year. Every year came the Day of Atonement. Every day there were the sacrifices, and they had to be offered perpetually. That's if you get to the high priest station in Judea, that's exactly what that's all about, that those sacrifices had to be offered every day continually because they never actually dealt with sin. All they did was cover sin. All they did was cover sin. But is that enough? And the survey says no. It's not enough. There needed to be something that would satisfy God's wrath against sin. And that couldn't have been done through the Aaronic priesthood. Just logic tells you it couldn't have been done because it had to be offered over and over and over again. And so because of that, there has to be something better, something superior, and there has to be a priest who is superior to that of Aaron. And that priest just so happens to be Jesus from the order of Melchizedek. So he makes the hypothetical question first, and then he answers it in a way that says, okay, so obviously there is a priest from the order of Melchizedek. There is Jesus, and he's different than Aaron. He's not Aaron. He's different than Aaron. So he goes, first of all, he says, for the one of who these things are, what things are he talking about? For the one of who these things are spoken of. What things is he talking about? Well, he's pointing back to Psalm 110, verse 4. He's pointing back to that promise back in Psalms 110 that said to the Messiah who was coming, forever you were a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And he's pointing that to Jesus being the one that's being spoken of. So we know that because verse 13 says, for the one of whom these things are spoken belong to another tribe from which no one has ever served the altar. So he says, here's the deal. The one Jesus who these things are spoken of is from another tribe and no other tribe ever served the altar. If you, and we're getting there in Sunday morning, we're eventually someday we're going to get there, where Levi is chosen to be the priestly tribe. Levi is chosen to be the priestly tribe. It really happens as they come out of Egypt. Remember the firstborn, death of the firstborn, and God has them number the firstborn in Israel. Number the Levites, and there's almost the exact same number, and God says, okay, I'm giving you your firstborn, but you're giving me the Levites. And so he uses them, the Levites become the priestly tribe, lose their inheritance of a land, and are then treated differently. Go ahead, Ron, you want to say something?
I can't hardly think of another case that illustrates so strongly why the Old and New Testament have to be taken together. Writer of Hebrews here wouldn't really have a leg to stand on if it weren't for Psalms 110.
You're exactly
and
right.
Psalm 110 would never be really understandable without Hebrews.
You're exactly right. I totally agree with that. If all you have is even with this with the statements of Melchizedek in Genesis 14, if that's all you have, then this conversation in Hebrews makes zero sense because there's no tie to Melchizedek and Messiah. What ties Melchizedek to Messiah is Psalm 110:4. That's the verse that does it. He's already used it once. He's going to use it again, and then he's going to use it again. He's actually going to use that verse three times in this section to demonstrate that this is a promise, a prophecy about Messiah relating him to Melchizedek. He's going to do it in verse 17 and in verse 21. He's going to do it again twice. He's already done it once. He's already done it earlier in the chapter. He's already done related to that prophecy in Psalm 110, verse 4. And it's a significant verse because it lays the foundation for. And it is that's one of those times when if it's just Genesis 14. Can't make the case that he's making. If it's just Psalm 110:4, And there's no introduction to this guy named Melchizedek. You got no case to make because you have, what's that even mean? Who's Melchizedek? Where does it come from? But because you have the history in Genesis 14, you have the promise in Psalm 110:4, then you can draw these conclusions that the author of Hebrews is making here, and it makes sense. It fits, and it's valid. It's valid. Now, you might say, well, he could make that conclusion without those two verses, without those two sections, because he's writing inspired scripture. Absolutely right. You could say that. But those conclusions would hold zero weight with the audience that's hearing him. You know, I could claim to be writing inspired scripture and make some kind of weird conclusion. And if there wasn't something to back it up, you'd say, yeah, that's woo, and you throw it away because it would be silliness. But because those two verses are there, those two sections of verses, Genesis 14, Psalm 110, then these conclusions are logical and based in truth, and so they make sense to the hearer, and the hearer has to seriously consider the things that are being said because of that. So it's really important. This is where it's one of those, I agree with that, the whole Bible, it's not just source material. The Old Testament, it's important. It's theologically important for even us as believers today. John? Yeah, they don't. They completely disregard the New Testament as spurious and as you know, the inventions of a group of guys who wanted to continue their sect. Yeah, so I think the best answer is what Brian said. They don't even consider it. Yeah, we'll talk about that. I'm going to get Harvey's in. That's a great question. A devout Jew would have known Genesis 14, would have known that this is a promise for Messiah, that Messiah is going to be a high priest, not just for the Jews, but a priest for all men. That's what's at focus there. Really, that's importance, and that's the significance of being a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Because being a high priest of the order of Melchizedek, he can serve as a priest for all of the tribes of the earth, not just Jews. And I think that's probably what they would have understood through that, is understood that you know, the priest that was coming would not be simply a priest of Aaron. And I think probably for them, it helped them as a Joe Jew, as a normal Jew. Why did it help them? Because if you look at the string of priests that had been high priests, just the ones we have recorded in the scripture are mostly scoundrels. You know, there are very few that actually do a good job of being high priest.
I have a related question. It seems like, and I didn't look it up, I had a question last week, and I didn't look it up. So, it seems like the Roman Catholic Church
I don't know that I've ever read that conversation taking place. I do know this, that there is definitely a concern that because of the teaching of Jesus, because of the upheaval, they are concerned about losing their place, about losing their position, about losing the favor of Rome, if there was really such a thing. Rome did not treat the Jews well at all. So there's no reason to get that in your head that they were enjoying this great time with Rome. That's not the case at all. But at least Rome was letting them practice their religion. At least Rome was giving them some kind of autonomy, some kind of authority. They were still very much oppressed. That's why they wanted to overthrow Rome. That's why the zealots especially wanted to overthrow Rome. That's why a lot of the folks early on followed Jesus, because they thought, okay, this is the guy. This is the guy. It's also important to note that Jesus is not the first self-proclaimed Messiah. There have been others. If you read the history of intertestamental history, he's like the fourth or fifth in line of messiahs who have risen up. But all the other guys were proven false and you know, didn't rise from the dead, first of all. That's a big deal. Yeah, they stayed dead. And there was no movement. After they died, there was nothing happened. They were done. That's the significant difference between Jesus and the other false messiahs. Jesus demonstrated who he was through the miracles that he did, proved who he was by raising from the dead, and is more proven that he was really Messiah because his church still exists today and has grown. It didn't fizzle out like the other guys did. Yeah, absolutely. The apostles were able to heal, you know, do stuff that's miraculous. That's why you see the miracles in Acts, is to show that authority and to show that continuation of the apostolic authority from Jesus to those guys and gives their ministry and their mission, the church, credibility. That's what's going on here. And so you know, it's Jesus isn't the first one who claimed to be Messiah, but he's the only one who demonstrated it, you know, three ways: by the power, by the miracles he did, by rising from the dead, and his legacy continuing. So he's different that way. So
I was just wondering if actually the Jewish concern and unwilling to relinquish their role as teachers of Israel, so to speak. I wonder if they were worried about losing their position, not just from Rome, but also from Jesus being able to do
it. I think absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I don't think that was. I don't think there's any question about that. That the priest felt threatened by that. That's why Caiaphas makes the recommendation he does. He's not.
But it's because they didn't want to lose their followers, right?
It's because they didn't want to lose their position. They could care less about followers. What they cared about was cash.
So their unbelief is really two-pronged.
Well, there's actually a demonstration because of what Caiaphas says. There's actually an indication that there may have been at least some recognition that he may have been that Messiah who would die. You see, because it was hard to get your head wrapped around Isaiah. It's hard to wrap your head around a Isaiah 53 King or Messiah, and an Isaiah 9 Messiah. I wrap my head around that. And so there was, and Ron will probably argue with me about how prevalent it was, but there was an understanding, there was a two Messiah understanding, that one Messiah would come and be the suffering servant who would die, and there would be a second Messiah who would then serve as king. They didn't get the resurrection. They didn't understand
that.
So
did they come from the one?
No, I don't know where they thought he would come from. Especially the Sadducees, especially had to take that into account, because the Sadducees did not believe in resurrection. And guess who the Sadducees were? They were the priests. The Sadducees were priests, and the priests denied resurrection, and so they had to believe in two messiahs. If you're going to have a Messiah that's led to the sheep as a slaughter, and doesn't open his mouth and is killed, and you don't believe in resurrection, you got to have another one. You got to have another one. That's what drives Caiaphas, I believe. That's what drives Caiaphas. When Jesus is demonstrating this power, Caiaphas, two things there. I mean, there may have been a recognition that this is what we want to do about this power. More of it's let's preserve ourselves. Let's get him out of here. Let's get him out of the way. Let's do what we did to the other guys and get him out of the way. That's what's really going on. But it makes it sound really spiritual when he says it's necessary for one to die for the people. In that, they're even in their attempt to silence Jesus, it's an attempt to protect them, their position, and attempt to protect themselves. That's what's going on there. That's clearly what's going on there. And it's all about position. It's all about cash. If people stop giving their temple money to the high priest and start giving it to Jesus as a Melchizedekian priest, then they lose their livelihood because they couldn't make money any other way. Priests couldn't do it, supposedly. In fact, if you remember when in Malachi, when Nehemiah comes, does his reforms, goes back to Persia for 10 years, comes back in 10 years and finds that the temple has basically been abandoned. The priests are out, you know, growing their own crops. And he says, that's not supposed to be the case. You guys get in here and start serving in the temple, and you guys do what you're supposed to do by supporting the priests. That seems to have stuck through the intertestamental period. And the priests were largely supported, especially the high priest was largely supported by the temple tax of the people. That's why they exaggerated the temple tax. They were very corrupt, very corrupt. So, Ron, you want to say something?
Well, I don't disagree with what you said. I think that in terms of around Jerusalem and around the country in most places, there was a lot more emphasis on how do we live rather than on how do you explain Isaiah 53. The big exception to that was the Dead Sea cult, which was... Probably, they called themselves the Yehud, whether they were Essenes or not. I don't think they were. There were two big differences, two big of differences between the two. But they may have been an offshoot of the Essenes, probably were. But they are the ones that really perfected that two Messiah approach in their writings. So you talked about there were a lot of false messiahs before. Of course, there have been a lot afterwards, too. I can't remember his name, but one of the big ones was a guy that claimed to be the Messiah, and a lot of people followed him, but then he converted to Islam.
Okay.
And more recently, the Lubavitchers in New York City followed a rabbi. I can't think of his name either, but he was supposed to be Messiah until he died, and they still hope he will come back to life. In fact, there's a Lubavitcher synagogue down the street from me. And then what you said, Joe Jew, use Yosef HaYehuda.
Yeah, okay.
Yosef HaYehuda.
Okay, let's quiet him down again. Go back to bed. Go back to sleep, Ron. Go sniff some gas fumes, okay?
Brian uses that term. I always get a good
job. Yeah. So, yeah, I always use Joju. Did we address everybody's comments? I thought maybe there was one more person that wanted to maybe say something. There's a big difference between an intellectual assent to a potential fact and an acceptance of by faith.
Right. That's
and I think that they may have, especially the priests in the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas leading them, may have recognized something was going on with Jesus. They had that conversation. What do we do about this guy? We don't. In fact, I think there's one conversation where they say, the stuff he's doing seems awfully real. We can't deny that. And the people really like him. And that scared them to death. that the people really liked him, because they didn't want the people to like him. They wanted the people to like them, and frankly, the people did not like the Sadducees. The people, I'll do it again, Joe Jew, did not like the Sadducees at all. They were holier than thou. They were thumbed their noses down and they were not well liked, the Sadducees, and the priests were not well liked. Now the Pharisees, different story altogether. The Pharisees were well liked because they were the ones that actually did the stuff. They did it from a heart of trying to make themselves look good, but they actually did give alms. They did give a lot of money. It rattled it around and stuff, but they did do that. So the Pharisees are well thought of. Sadducees are not well thought of. And because of that, they had to grasp, cling tightly to any kind of popularity they could get. And when this Messiah comes, or Jesus comes, and the people like him, really, really, really like him, they got to shut him up. Because they're really concerned about losing their place, losing their position, and losing the ability to have an income, to have money. And I think it's all driven by money. I mean, so it's not even, and I think the it's necessary for one to die for people. They're using an Old Testament straw man to support their position, basically. We want to kill this guy, but you can't kill a guy that everybody likes, right? That's going to be a problem unless you can demonstrate a good reason to kill him. So, ding, 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 ding. Here's a good reason to kill him. One's got to die for the people. So let's kill him for that reason. So I don't know that if you're a regular Jew, you're thinking, oh, we're going to kill our Messiah. I don't think that's what, I think they're probably thinking Rome will kill our Messiah. That's probably what they're thinking. If you're watching history and you're thinking about it and you say, okay, we're going to have a Messiah who's going to die, who's likely going to kill that Messiah? Rome is going to kill the Messiah. You're not thinking, oh, we're going to do it? This guy's the Messiah. And let me correct here. We're going to kill the guy? Yeah, we have to, because it's expedient. It's good for everybody if we do this. Good for everybody if we do this. That's what they're trying to sell. Sounds shaky. It was shaky. But it was just an excuse to try to provide some kind of justification for them killing the Messiah, or killing Jesus, because there's no other way they could do it. And they couldn't deny the miracles he was doing. They couldn't say, no, you're not alive, to a guy who'd been dead and rose again. You couldn't do that. To Lazarus, you couldn't say, no, by the way, you really are still dead, man. The greatest display of all that is when the man born blind is healed. Jesus heals him, and he's walking around and he's telling everybody about this Jesus guy who healed him, and Sanhedrin hears that and they call him and say, hey. And so then there's this question. They bring his parents in. He wasn't really blind, was he? He wasn't really blind. Yeah, he was really blind. But they're scared to death of everything. We got no clue. We're out of here. We don't even love the kid. They completely turn their back on the poor guy. We don't even love the guy. Just no, we're done. And then when he stands before them, he says to this, and this is something they can't refute. I don't know what you're going to say about this. This is my paraphrase. I was blind. Now I see. What are you going to do about that? you can say whatever you want to say. I was blind, now I see, deal with it. And the Sanhedrin, recognizing that kind of stuff, we can't deny the miracles. We got blind guys walking around seeing, we got lame guys jumping up and down. We got stuff going, you can't deny it. So let's kill him. That's the next logical step they took was, we can't deny him, so let's kill him. So they do that. They kill him. And in an attempt to justify the killing, they try to attach a biblical significance to that killing, that they were just making up a reason. I don't think there's any indication that any of them really did truly, yeah, it's really good. With the exception of maybe Nicodemus, who I think had removed himself from that discussion. So good.
Rabbi Menachem Schneerson was the
rabbi.
Really an important guy. He did a lot of good things in the world and in the country. Mm. He was not the Messiah.
Yeah. No, he's not the Messiah. We got that proven. We know who Messiah is. How do we even get there? I don't know how we got there. Chapter 7. I had not planned to go there at all, by the way, but try to get back in this. Try to get back. I'm trying to figure out how we even got there. I mean, I'm glad it was fun to get there. It was fun to get there, but I just can't figure out. Maybe we need to replay the tape and figure out where I was before we got there, because I can't remember right now where I was before we got there. Oh, okay. Okay, so, yeah, okay. So we are actually on the, we're actually talking about, the, that's what, good, thank you. So because there was, you know, if you're a Jew and you have any kind of recognition of Scripture, you recognize that Jesus could never have been a priest. And so when you've heard the author of Hebrews twice say that he is a high priest, Hebrews 2, Hebrews 4, then you should have red flags. You should have red flags. And so how could Jesus then be a priest? Well, he's a priest because of Psalm 110:4 that says that the Messiah is going to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. That's what he's going to be. And so now he ties, again, what he's doing is he's tying us back into the first 10 verses, but more significantly and more importantly, tying us back into the last verse of chapter 6 where he lays the foundation for Jesus being a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And he's saying that's very, very important. And it's important because Jesus is not a Levite. He's not a Levite. And he says it. He says he's the one from who these things are spoken, belong to another tribe from which no one has ever served at the altar. So from the tribe of Judah, there's never been a altar-serving priest that came from the tribe of Judah because they weren't supposed to. They were prohibited from offering sacrifice. All the other tribes were not only not able to, but they were prohibited from offering sacrifice. The only tribe that could offer sacrifice was the tribe of Levi. That's the only one that could do it. And so for Jesus then to step up and say, I'm the high priest who sprinkled my blood in the Holy of Holies, well, you should have died the minute you walked in the door. There should be no way you could do that because you can't serve as high priest for Israel. And so it's really important that he's not serving as high priest for Israel. He's serving as high priest for all mankind. From a priesthood that supersedes and precedes that of Aaron. So that's why it's really important for him to know that. So I thought I saw a hand go up. So he says, first of all, not only did no one has ever served, but it's... He says, and from it's evident that our Lord was descended from Judah. So we get that. Jesus descended from Judah in Matthew and Luke, right? Matthew and Luke, there are two genealogies. Matthew's genealogy traces Joseph, and Luke's genealogy traces Mary. And they both trace back to David, and they both trace back to Judah. They both trace all the way back to Judah. So there's that common... thing. So if you say, well, if you read Matthew, well, that's Joseph's genealogy, and Joseph really isn't his dad at all, right? Joseph isn't Jesus' father. He's not even, there's no Joseph in Jesus at all, because the Holy Spirit is Jesus' father. So you would say, well, he's not really, I mean, yeah, okay, because his stepdad is from Judah. So you could maybe throw that one off. But his mom also is from Judah. So the one earthly relative he has is from Judah. So he fits. And it's really neat. They both descend from David. They're both Davidic. So he actually he stands and can stand as king after the line of David because both Joseph and Mary descend from David. So it fits that he can be, that Jesus is that king. But beyond that, because we know he's descended from Judah, that means he can't be a priest. Can't be a priest. That's what he says. because in connection with that tribe, Judah, Moses said nothing about priests. The only priestly tribe ever is from Levi. That's the only priestly tribe. And it ties back to coming out of Egypt, the death of the firstborn, and the giving of the Levites in their place. God takes them and establishes them as the priest at that point. Those are going to be the priests. Which even, it's even significant there because as you get to where we're going to get to Sunday morning in Sunday school, Exodus 24, Moses is going to actually offer a sacrifice. Can Moses offer sacrifice? He could even after they were instituted because Moses is from the tribe of Levi. Moses is from the priestly tribe. Now, he can't be the high priest. Moses can't be the high priest. Kind of interesting. Moses can't be the high priest because the high priest has to come from Aaron and his descendants, and Moses is a brother over here. So, Moses, but he is Levi. He is from the tribe of Levi, so he actually doesn't usurp a place even to offer sacrifice by offering that sacrifice. So that's just, you get that one for free. I'm going to give that one free. So as he begins the conversation, he says, if the Aaronic priesthood would have been good enough, you don't need another priest. But it's not. The understanding there, it's not good enough, so we need someone else. And because Jesus is a priest not from the order of Aaron, and it's impossible for Jesus to be an Aaronic priest. It's impossible. That's where he's disassociating him from that Aaronic priest. He says there's no way. There's no way Jesus is an Aaronic priest. We know that for a fact. First of all, we know he's descended from Judah, and there's no place ever where anybody from Judah is ever said they could be a priest. It's in the law of Moses, it's prohibited for a Judite to become a priest. So he disassociates Jesus from Aaron while he's associating Jesus with Melchizedek. He wants to point the clear difference out in this priesthood. He wants to point the clear difference out. That's where he goes next. So he disassociates. The first section is disassociation from Aaron. The next section is association with Melchizedek. It says, verse 15. I got a little bit of time. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek. He has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For as witness of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So now he's now associating with Melchizedek. He's disassociated from Aaron, associating with Melchizedek, and he says it's even more evident when another priest that is similar to in the likeness of Melchizedek arises. And how does he arise? Well, he arises the same way Melchizedek arose. Not because he had parents who were priests. It's not why. Remember, Melchizedek is talked about not had mother or father. And it's not that he didn't have a mother or father. It's that it's not recorded whose mother or father was. And so he's raised up as a priest not because he's born to it, but because of the life that he lived. And that's exactly what he said about Jesus. He's not a priest because he was born to it. Legally, he's a priest because of the indestructible life that he lived, because of this life that he lived that was first of all perfect, and then when he was killed, he raised from that. His life is an indestructible life, which proves not that he's from Aaron, but he's from Melchizedek. He follows that pattern that was laid out in the second section there of the first 10 verses. Regarding the similarities between Jesus and Melchizedek. He's playing on that, where it's interesting. He uses the last part of like 5 through 10, he uses that to show how Melchizedek is like Jesus, and he uses this to show how Jesus is like Melchizedek. It's kind of an interesting logical shift on his part, but he's definitely making a connection between Jesus and Melchizedek and showing that this is really significant. He's showing the importance of that. So then that's actually going to take us now the rest of the way through Hebrews chapter 7. So we won't get through that today, of course, since we only have like 5 minutes left. Ben, Ron?
when the ESV says a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, I think it makes more sense with the translation I have over here. One who becomes a Kohen not by virtue of a rule or a mitzvah in Torah concerning physical descent, because that's another important subject to come here, that there's a transformation of Torah.
Yes.
So this isn't a civil law kind of thing or anything like that.
Yeah. Ron is right, and that's something that I did want to talk about, but in Harvey's hijacking of this class this morning, that's something I didn't get to. So I will go back to that. We're not done with those first verses because he does. I need to talk about that statement about the law. And I didn't talk about that. So I will I will go back to that, and we'll talk about that next week. I don't have time to talk about it now.
Well, I just guess I want to say to everybody, I apologize if I talk too much. This concept, to me, is almost like...
You don't have to apologize.
Well, I'm just telling. To me, this is because I can't not believe I haven't understood this for so many years. Seriously. And I'm like, this is too many, like, to me, it's just like, serious
about this.
I'm like, where have I been for 40 years? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's what to me, Hebrew, because it just explodes.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
You don't have to be sorry, Harv. I'm going to give you, don't have to tone it down at all.
It's evidently, you worked with us in the old office on Berlin.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
When we studied this before.
Yeah. You don't. You can ask. Anybody can ask any question they want to ask. I'd rather you did that than sit there with a question and not answer it, and not ask it. And if I can't answer it, I'll just tell you I can't answer it. But I'm going to take a shot at it. So I'm just giving you a hard time. I understand. I'm just giving you a hard time. You're not the first person that's hijacked a lesson. I wasn't pointing at you. I wasn't pointing at you at all. It was him pointing at you. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
He does hijack quite a few as well. So
and him, he does what?
He tries. He tries.
I'm not as persistent.
And he has been known to as well.
Yeah.
Man, there's a lot of finger pointing.
Yeah,
see, one at each.
You know, when
table.
You point, you got three fingers pointing back at you.
Yeah, unless you've had some cut off. So anyhow, we'll finish that. But I do want to talk about that, how the law changes and how that. And I think that's really important to talk about that. So we will talk about that.